Hello and welcome to Media Industry Conversations. I'm your host, Hannah Wold. This program is part of an ongoing speaker series at the University of Texas at Austin. It's co-sponsored by the Department of Radio, Television, Film and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries. This series allows students to meet and hear from industry professionals who share their experiences, knowledge, and thoughts on the rapidly changing media landscape. Thanks to RTF, CME, and our guest speakers, this podcast can now make those interviews widely accessible. This week's guest is Jordan Levin. At the time of his visit, Jordan was general manager at Rooster Teeth, an Austin-based media and entertainment company where he was responsible for leading all aspects of the business, including oversight of strategy, creative, and operations. Before joining Rooster Teeth in 2019, Levin served as the CEO of Awesomeness, where he oversaw the growth of the company's leading digital networks. He also managed its world-class film and television studio, which was behind hits like the Netflix feature film To All the Boys I've Loved Before and Hulu's critically acclaimed Pen 15. In addition to his work at companies like the NFL and Xbox, Jordan notably worked on the founding team of the WB Television Network, now known as the CW, where he built shows like Dawson's Creek, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Felicity, Smallville, Gilmore Girls, and Charmed. Jordan spoke to UT students on October 10th, 2022, at a time when Hollywood was focused on the streaming wars, the rise of IP, and a wave of mergers and acquisitions. The conversation was hosted by Dr. Elisa Perrin and focused on Jordan's career trajectory, the nuances of building a broadcast network, and the nature of digital content in the current media landscape.
Welcome. And I've already cued the class a bit to your background, but I'm excited to be talking. Jordan has experienced so much of the transformation of the media industries and television industries firsthand. From talent management to network to studio to production company to everything in between.
I'm a bit of a weirdo. I mean, now that everything's sort of all mushed around and the lines are pretty blurred, I've got a place where I'm a little bit more representative, I guess, of the industry overall. But for a while, where everyone would box you into categories, I was a seller on the studio side, a buyer on the network side. So I was an executive, but then I was a producer and a director. And then I played in emerging digital as well as traditional media as that divide started to open up. So it always used to throw people.
But I think it's good for our sort of mid-semester check-in of how the TV industry in particular has changed and the media industries. But let's start off right now first, just with you telling everyone, so we're sure we get here, what you do these days in your position as general manager for Rooster Teeth.
I came into Rooster Teeth. Rooster Teeth's almost a 20-year-old company, started in Austin by two former UT students, met at Texas Student Television, and they essentially started to create content for themselves. They loved what they did at TSTV. 2003 is when the company got started. They were frustrated by the fact that they went to Hollywood, or one of them went to Hollywood, the other was trying to write, you know, movies and do what they were doing in college here. And they realized, we got to go through these gatekeepers. You know, they sold an idea to television. They thought, great, we're in good shape. And then realized they wound up in development hell. And they just felt like there's got to be a different way where they could continue to create and make things, because they believed there was an audience that would like what they did because there were people like them. So they started to use early online video in the days before YouTube to post some videos. And they did something that became a big hit, which was they essentially created of sorts the machinima form. They took the Halo video game and they puppeteered Halo into this existential comedy called Red versus Blue that became a big hit. And from that, they grew and started to make more content, animation, comedy, a lot of things around gaming, gaming lifestyle, gaming culture. Company got bought. We'll go through its iterations of how it wound up in a big media company, but it's in Warner Brothers Discovery, Warner Brothers Discovery's purview right now. And they, along with some of the Warner Media folks at the time, asked if I would come in to help manage it, primarily so some of them could get back doing creative work, and they could have someone who could help manage through all the corporate mishigas. The Yiddish word that is what it sounds like. So that's what I've been doing for 3 years. I knew them through UT connections, and just I had a company that was playing an early online video. And for those of us who were the first sort of in, you just knew what each other was doing, got to know one another. And since I'm a UT grad, always plan to come back to Austin, empty nest, timing worked out. So here I am to help them through the transitions they're going through.
Yeah. And so when you came on board, was AT&T already the owner?
AT&T was the owner at that point in time. Well, no, I'm sorry. At that point, AT&T owned all of Warner Media.
Right, right.
So it had wound its way into Warner Media.
Right. Okay. It's hard to keep track of all the...
And that's when I got the call.
Changes. Yes. Okay. And we'll return to that.
Okay.
But let's go back in time a little bit. And talk a little bit about your time here at UT. Like, what did you do here? How did you sort of get experience and figure out your interest in the industry at that point in time?
I wanted to be a director. I made films growing up. I came here to shoot and go into the production track. And at that point in time, sort of similar to now, although because production was still very dependent on film and shooting film and not heavily on video, getting your hands on the equipment was the name of the game. And the course load for production relegated you almost exclusively to production. And I took the early narrative strategies class, Professor Tom Schatz, who I know you all heard from earlier this semester and who's graced our presence here today. And Tom started, you know, doing what Tom does, started talking about series and movies and how stories are told. And I was just seduced into that. And I loved doing that and realized if I went in production, I couldn't do that. I couldn't take English courses. I couldn't take theater courses. And I was just really interested in storytelling. So I started going down that path. That also, I was interested in the industry. Started taking some of the like business of Hollywood like courses. There wasn't a lot of media industry studies here at the time. So Tom, along with the chair of the department at the time, Horace Newcomb, they sort of took me under their wing. I did independent studies with them, really used the entertainment trades as my textbooks, if you will, and just started writing about the industry. And so between those things, theory and criticism and studying the industry, started to form a more cohesive point of view about where the industry was at that time, which was going through some pretty big transitions and sort of where I thought it might be going from there to at least, again, have a point of view entering into a career in the business.
And if you don't mind saying sort of what your, it was a thesis project you did, right?
Right. I get held up. This gets held up a lot to prove the value of a senior thesis, but this is true. I was studying the television industry during this period of in the late 80s, which had a lot going on, which I know you've studied some of it. And I essentially wrote this thesis that argued that the era of broadcast television's dominance was in decline as cable television emerged, as the Fox network, which was new, emerged. And that networks essentially had to pick a seat, that they needed to have a brand and stand for something instead of trying to be all things to all people. And that ended up really, in a lot of ways, orienting where I went, including getting hired out of college by the first head of programming at Fox, who couldn't believe someone would write that thesis and then read it and was like, oh, well, you know, if you're that interested, come in.
Yeah. So where was that you started?
It was at Disney. So Disney in 1989 was still under relatively new management. Disney was almost broken up into pieces in the mid 80s. And Walt Disney's nephew, Roy Disney, right? Was his nephew, right? So, appealed to the Bass brothers, who were these financiers from Dallas, and said, sort of, save this, don't let his heirs break the company up. And they brought in Michael Eisner, who brought in Jeffrey Katzenberg and the whole team over from Paramount. And Paramount in the 80s was this just hit machine in movies and television. Brought them in along with this guy named Frank Wells, who was this legendary studio head from Warner Brothers during also that era of the 70s and 80s, sort of the adult in the room with these creative wunderkinds. And they tackled the business systematically. Systematically. I think that's right. They went after the movie, live action movie business first. Then they said, we want to fix animation. And then they decided to go after TV. And so they invested all this money making overall deals with big, successful TV showrunners, sort of the name of the game, especially back then, but still is today. If you think about big A-level showrunners and their value to people who are buying content, want to be with people who are proven. And I got to be what was called an associate, which was entry level, but it was a really small group. So I got to do a lot of things, which was great.
So yeah, what was it like? Because this was, I think it's important to note, you were at Disney in the early 90s. This is when Disney's a studio, but they don't have a network yet, right?
Right. This is this era where it's essentially the last gasp of the broadcast network's dominance, where the broadcast networks were still forbidden to own the programs on the networks. So the government said, networks, distributors, you have a monopoly. There's really only three of you. It's a massive cost to build those networks because you have to put up TV stations and, you know, all and create affiliates. And so just the infrastructure TV created high barrier of entries. CBS and NBC, the two giant legacy networks. ABC, sort of the baby network that in a lot of ways was the precursor to Fox, and then the WB, now the CW, newer network, found its niche going after younger audiences, doing things a little differently. So there's three networks. Fox comes along, and Fox tries to create this fourth network, and Fox gets under the hourly cap. There was a rule that said, you're technically not a network if you don't program the 27 hours a week, the 3 hours every night, 4 hours on Sunday. Fox was just doing 2 hours a night. So it started to own its own programs, not all of them. They bought from other people. And that started to, along with changes in government and the FTC, started to collapse these rules. And so Disney builds this TV studio up in this era when, the name of the game was getting on broadcast. There was a reticence even to put anything on Fox, let alone on cable, which was just starting to play with new series, because the whole business model of a TV studio back then was this really sort of like high stakes gamble. It was sort of like wildcatting. If you got a show into syndication, which meant you basically sold the rerun rights, you made a fortune. But if you didn't, you ate it. Because the way that TV worked back then was a TV network would license a show. They wouldn't own it. And in exchange for that license, they get to run it like five times over the course of a couple of years. And they would pay for the majority of the cost of it. But the studio would deficit finance the remaining cost of it, and just accrue that loss on all these shows in the hopes that it would go 100 episodes. Why 100 episodes? Because 100 episodes is what TV stations needed as a threshold to run those repeats, you know, 5 days a week. So like a Friends repeat 5 days a week needed 100 episodes so that for 2 years, it would be relatively fresh. So that was the nature of the business. And, you know, we like, it's still a very hits driven business. You could go a year and your show gets canceled. That's 22 times your deficit, 200,000. You're just in the red. But the whole name of the game was like, how do I get something to place where TV stations, the majority of whom were not owned by the networks, were independent TV stations. There were caps that the government created where ownership groups could only own so much. They didn't want too much influence. So all these independent TV station groups would need stuff to run, you know, late at night in repeats, like Seinfeld late at night, you know, and 6 to 7 earlier in the day, in the afternoon. And you wanted things that could play off network. And that just shaped the business. The whole business for studios was, how do I get the networks to buy something that I think is going to be really valuable in repeat? Which is really an interesting mindset, because the networks are thinking about, what can I get that I can sell advertising against? And the tastes of audiences started to shift towards content that was more sophisticated, in some ways a little more serialized, than would work episodically in repeats. Like if something was heavily serialized, that was like a lot, you know, if you missed a day or two in repeats, you get a little lost. So it was this time where comedies were all over the place. There were hardly any dramas. Dramas generally would make their money not so much in repeats. Dramas made their money largely through international sales. And so what worked internationally, like Cops, you know, anything with law, anything with crime, anything procedural, as it's called, closed-ended procedurals. So you saw a lot of that at the time. And then you saw a lot of comedies, the large majority of which were sitcoms, you know, 3-camera sitcoms in front of a studio audience, because single camera comedy was more expensive. And so that risk of taking on deficit was harder to absorb. And that sort of that was the TV business for a decent amount of time. But Fox changed it, and the rules started to change, and that then led to this collapse of the rules about how much the networks could own of their own content. The government started to say, okay, you can own some of it, not all of it. And so the network stuck their toe in the water, and they created these production companies, which were essentially in-house studios. Like there was NBC Studios and there was ABC Studios, and I don't think CBS did one so much at the time. And they started to build up, and they wanted to control their real estate. And when they got really aggressive, they started to say, okay, Warner Brothers or Disney or Sony or Columbia Television, TriStar Television, if you want your show picked up, you're going to split ownership with NBC Studios. You're going to split ownership with ABC Studios.
So a couple questions, comments. First of all, I think it's hilarious that you used Friends and Seinfeld as your two examples, which are always the ones that I seem to go to.
Only like, because if I go way back, we're talking like MASH or shows. Yeah. I'm not even sure how, you know, on your old radar or not.
And it's worth noting, just to plant like Robert Iger, who was here. So he was at ABC Cap Cities, and he became part of Disney because
We used to sell shows to Bob when Bob was head of the ABC network, which at that point, ABC, CBS, NBC, independently owned by, at that point, different conglomerates, although ABC was owned by this TV station group called Cap Cities, and Bob came up through Cap Cities.
So, okay, what kind of shows did you work on at Disney? What did you do? And then what was the leap like? Because you went to the WB from there, right? Maybe you can talk a lot about that.
Biggest things I did at Disney, thing I'm probably proudest of is I helped build this fellowship program, which is now their writing program for primarily for underrepresented writers. Like Shonda Rhimes came out of that program. And that was the first program of its kind to do that. And that's had a really lasting impact. And then I worked on shows which don't have as lasting an impact. And some do, some don't. It's funny, again, how y'all came up watching these repeats, likely on cable instead of TV stations. But for some reason, Boy Meets World always seems to be appreciated. show like Blossom or Herman's Head, oddly, is appreciated. The biggest show we did was Home Improvement, which doesn't really last all that much, from Tim Allen. But that literally made like over $1 billion. That one show covered probably 5, 6, 7 years of shows that didn't work and fail. You know, all those deficits get covered by that one giant hit. I got my start working on Golden Girls, which I know lasts throughout time, staffed a lot of the writers on that show. Ellen DeGeneres' first sitcom, Ellen, was another one. But again, basically, because it was really small, I got to do a lot. And I in television, in this nomenclature still holds true to some degree. There's two, relatively speaking, there's two types of executive positions in the creative executive role. There's current programming and there's development. And again, those lines blur a lot, but current programming means you're overseeing a show in production. So you're helping to identify the writers to staff that show every season as writers come in and out. You're identifying the directors who direct those episodes. You're approving storylines, big story arcs. You're approving episodic outlines. You're going to the tapings, or you're watching the dailies or the rushes, all the cuts, giving notes on cuts, liaising with studio or network, depending on what side you're on. Development is really about, what do you think development is? Identifying ideas, working with writers and creators, looking for underlying intellectual property, identifying talent, comics to build shows around. And I was doing a little bit of both. And really, I think the lesson I learned from that more than anything was I went into a startup situation, which in some ways, or reboot, I should say, which in some ways has more risk to it. But I've always found if you can go somewhere where you feel like you can contribute and your voice is going to get heard, that those opportunities create bigger professional career opportunities than going into companies that are at the top of their game, or divisions at the top of their game, where everyone wants to be there. And there's a lot of people competing within those companies to be heard. Sort of, you know, a smaller sort of entrepreneurial type of opportunity creates a lot more room to be impactful.
Which leads us to the WB.
Yeah.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about what it was like to be on the bottom floor of starting a new network and sort of what the WB was, because I don't know how many people in here even really have a resonance with. How many of you are familiar with what's on the WB or what was on the WB? Not many people at this point. Yeah. So that's
now, how many are familiar with the CW?
Okay.
Okay. So this WB was the CW. And what happened was, I guess this leads into why the WB get created. So, and stop me if I start running too long or get confusing here. Please raise hands if this isn't making sense. So let's go back. The government starts to raise these limits on studio network ownership. And this is coming at a time of these entertainment companies, which were generally divided by studios, movie and TV studios and networks, start coming together in these funny shapes and sizes. You know, CBS is owned by Westinghouse, NBC is owned by GE, right? And then Vivendi comes in there at some point, which is this utility, water utility company in France, and ABC, like I said, Cap Cities. Murdoch owns Fox now. So those walls start coming down. And the studios, who are the big suppliers, start getting real nervous because they've already seen what the networks are doing now that they have their own production companies. They're starting to get squeezed. And these are the big money makers for the studios. As glamorous as the movie business is, and as much as the movie business represents sort of the top of the pyramid in terms of profile, the engine that makes money for studios is TV. And Warner Brothers, and in the 5 years I was there, Disney became the two biggest suppliers of TV shows to networks. Paramount, also a big supplier, along with Columbia and TriStar, which is then gets bought by Sony. They all start getting concerned, I'm going to get squeezed out of this business. I need a network, or I need a hedge bet to make sure I don't get squeezed out. So you start to see and hear all these rumblings that are coming together. Ultimately, it leads to NBC and Universal coming together. It leads to ABC and Disney coming together after I left. But Warner Brothers, which is flirting around with NBC as well, Warner Brothers and Paramount both decide there's room for a fifth broadcast network. And it's pitched by this, my boss, who was head of the Fox network. And he leaves Fox along with that founding team of Fox, because Fox figured out that the key to success was going young and being a young skewing network with shows like 21 Jump Street and The Simpsons and Married with Children. Some of the others you heard. Now, when they got their start, interestingly, they tried to be a big broadcast network. They tried to compete against CBS and ABC and NBC, and they fell on their face. And the only thing that worked were these younger skewing shows. And what they realized is the people are watching the TV stations that made up the Fox network were largely people who didn't like what was on NBC and generally disenfranchised audiences. This is a theme that'll come back again and again. Disenfranchised audiences who are early adopters trying new things generally are young people. Young people, other disenfranchised identity groups. So they start having success in Living Color, start having success with these shows. Rupert Murdoch is very competitive. He wants a big broadcast network. He makes this move to buy the NFL's NFC rights from CBS. And that changes all these TV station ownership. The stations that were the CBS affiliates in big markets basically say, screw you, CBS. I'm going over to Fox. So Fox decides we're going old or older. We're going after 18 to 49, just like ABC, CBS, NBC. And the team at Fox basically says, we don't want to be in that game. We think there's this opportunity to start a new network based on what we learned and the fact that there's more TV stations growing. But let's start young this time and not spend 2 years spinning our wheels trying to figure it out. Now, the reason there's all these TV stations is because if you've ever played around with an antenna or try to get free TV these days, there was a thing called VHF stations and UHF stations. And VHF stations are essentially channel position 2 through 13. And UHF stations are everything above. Now, back in the days before cable, VHF stations came in like crystal clear. They were great. So channel 7, Fox here in town, perfect. You could see it, up to Waco. Anything that was a UHF station was really fuzzy and pretty shitty to get reception. But when cable comes along, it levels the playing field. because all the sun on your cable box, they're all stacked up all next to each other. So all of a sudden these UHF stations start having all this value. And for the TV station ownership groups, this is probably too much information, but it goes to the government regulation. Government basically said, UHF station is worth half of a VHF station. So these station groups could acquire more and more stations and still live under the cap because UHF station only counted as a half station. So there's enough new UHF stations in the market that everyone thinks, okay, there's going to be one last broadcast network. There's going to be a fifth broadcast network, and that's it. So the ex-Fox guys run around and talk to Paramount, talk to Warner Brothers, talk to some of the big station groups. The two biggest station groups that were independent were Tribune and this group called the United Chris Graff Group. Basically, the way it sorts out is that Warner Brothers partners with the ex-Fox team to start the WB network with the Tribune station group. And there's another TV network. Paramount gets panicked, and Paramount partners with United Chris Graff Group to create UPN, United Paramount Network. And both are competing against each other. And really interestingly, in my opinion at least, they had completely different business models. The WB basically decides, and Warner Brothers and Tribune, that the most important thing to get out of the gate is a good programming team. UPN decides the most important thing to get out of the gate is just the best distribution you can get. And the way they go about getting distribution is they pay their affiliates, which at the time, it's called affiliate compensation, I should say. Affiliate compensation was the way that a lot of these mom and pop stations kept the lights on. They would get local advertising during their local news and when they ran repeats. But they got essentially the subsidy from the network. And networks were making so much money at the time, that really worked for a while. But my boss, who's really smart, realized that as the network dominance was shrinking, that was going to go away. And so the WB basically said, you're going to pay us. That's not really attractive, especially when Paramount's out there saying, we'll pay you and we'll give you the new Star Trek and we'll give you Cheers repeats and all these things. So UPN launches with better stations. WB starts out, has a little bit of a rocky patch going after comedies, but starts to have real success, essentially creating more cinematic like television for younger audiences that is heavily serialized with young creators who've never really created TV before, breaking a lot of rules and creating shows like Dawson's Creek and Gilmore Girls and Felicity and Smallville and One Tree Hill and Charmed and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Thank you. And number of other hit shows and really gets in this groove with people like Greg Berlanti and J.J. Abrams and Ryan Murphy, who created a show called Popular, and Kevin Williamson and Joss Whedon, and creates all these stars and takes a lot of UPN stations away and really starts winning this race. Flash forward, after about 10 years, I was doing all the programming and development with a very small group, again, tiny group, sort of rose through the ranks to co-president of entertainment and sole president. So I was sort of the last person standing, the CEO, created it, leaves. And the Warner Brothers management decides they want to age the network up. And they want to age the network up because those shows, which did really well and were highly coveted by advertisers, because they reached young audiences in a way that no other television networks reached, they didn't syndicate really well because they were serialized. They were really character-based. And at that point in time, there wasn't like a DVD business yet. So they want to age the network up and have shows that are more close-ended, a little bit more, again, franchise-based. I didn't think that would be successful in a very loving way. We parted ways every 10 years. They tried to age the network up. It did undercut their success with advertisers, the brand, the audience. Meanwhile, UPN, which, longer story, but gets Buffy and some renegotiation rights from 20th Century Fox Television, they're struggling. And at this point, Paramount and CBS had come together. And Paramount and CBS and Warner Brothers decide, there's only room, let's combine forces. So CW is C is the CBS, which replaced UPN, W is WB. And the majority of shows on that network were coming from the WB and then sort of replicated that WB model. And the reason they could do it is at that moment in time, the DVD business starts to pick up. DVDs start to really work, which is where a lot of those shows I just mentioned start to get noticed. And then that leads to streaming. As the home video business starts to decline, the streamers are looking for stuff. And a lot of those shows ended up going on to Netflix and discovering a new audience. So it's really weird for me to see that you all know the shows, but you don't know the WB, which in a lot of ways makes sense. It was around for 10 years, but its influence was largely this more cinematic style of storytelling, where it wasn't all drama or it wasn't all comedy. It was more character-based with comedy and drama, shot in a way that was more movie-like, written by young filmmakers. Contemporary music brought into TV shows for the first time. And you started to see that proliferate across a lot of TV.
So that's really helpful overview and also sort of reinforcing and taking further what we talked about in class. I'm curious, because we've been talking about like the networks and studios coming together, like how are things different now in terms of that relationship from your perspective?
Well, it's a really good question. It's interesting. So once the networks and studios combine, the networks get greedy and try to basically own all of their primetime schedule. And they realize that's a really expensive bet. They've essentially doubled down on everything because now you're not just paying a portion of the cost of the shows. You're paying everything for those shows. And again, if they didn't own it and it was coming from some other supplier, and the reason they usually would have to accept another supplier is the power of a showrunner. So, hey, if you want to be in the Greg Berlanti business, you gotta be in business with Warner Brothers. But if Warner Brothers wants Greg's show on CBS, CBS is gonna demand half of it. It all depended on your leverage and how badly a show was run on, so on and so forth. But ultimately the networks sort of bite off more than they can chew because this hit ratio just isn't that high. Like you take on that failure, especially at a time when there's more and more networks and cable starting to build and there's original production starting to merge around the world. So that off network marketplace starts to decline. Home video helps it out, but in general, like the business is starting to contract a little bit. And so they start to buy again from each other. So they're all sort of doing business with one another. But there's also this another wave of mergers and acquisition that creates these even bigger conglomerates. So you start to see a lot of independent production companies, a lot of independent studios getting folded in and collapsed in. Like Aaron Spelling, who was a prolific TV producer, who when I was growing up, you know, did Charlie's Angels and The Love Boat, and then he did Charmed and Seventh Heaven for us, and he did 90210 and Melrose Place for Fox, and he gets bought by Paramount CBS, you know, his company. There's just this consolidation play that happens. And as that consolidation play happens, you start to shrink the number of entertainment companies down to a point where you're starting to get back into almost a broadcast era where, you know, instead of 10, 12 big companies, there's five sort of controlling everything. You know, if you're a showrunner and you need to do a deal, you're doing a deal now sort of with the network and the studio. Cable companies and cable networks are getting either folded into these big conglomerates or doing the buying. You know, the MTV networks becomes part of CBS, Paramount, Viacom, now called Paramount, like all these changing names, which are really hard to follow. But then there's also this competitor in Netflix who is basically taking these off network rights, or in the case of the CW, is essentially replacing that home video money and getting the rights to these shows. And same thing with AMC networks, like all these places that couldn't fund shows are selling Netflix. And so the traditional entertainment companies are the ones who really build Netflix and build their competitor that ends up being the giant, massive disruptor and starts to let tech in the door. Netflix paves the way for Amazon. Netflix paves the way, you know, for Apple. And, you know, what you've studied and you will be studying is there's always this sort of back and forth. Again, if you think of wildcatting, is it the oil well or is it the pipelines? You know, it's the same thing. Is it distribution strength or is it strength of content? And it always is this game sort of going back and forth. And up until really last year when Wall Street completely sort of flipped how it looked at these businesses and started to focus on bottom line versus subscribers, they were rewarding Netflix and sub growth. So they were basically rewarding the pipe, the distribution platform. And now again, now they're starting to focus on, okay, who's got the intellectual property and the underlying rights and content. So you get into this funny back and forth.
So I'm curious, to take us a little to the present day, you're working for Warners again. And I'm curious, like, how do you see life under Warners with Rooster Teeth versus, well, we should say Discovery as well, versus when you were under Warners back in the day?
When I was under Warners back in the day, I mean, that late 90s, that was an era. When I came up, the people who ran the entertainment business were largely people came up through creative ranks. Like if you think of it in simple manufacturing, it was people who knew how to build, you know, the car. They were sort of on the factory floor and then sort of worked their way up into upper management. Like Bob Iger has creative background. The business, as all these companies start to combine, starts to get more and more run by business people, MBAs, strategic people come out of what typically called strategic planning departments. And now with infusion of tech, people don't really have a background in a lot of cases with, you know, any content business. And so the business is controlled and the decision-making is controlled more and more, not only by business people, but business people are really looking more at the bottom line and looking at data and analytics as compared to creative people making bets on talent and ideas and content, which generally leads to a mindset of what's worked or what is working and how do I do that? You know, so it's like hitch-driven mentality of, oh, you know, Game of Thrones worked, I want mine. Lord of the Rings, Amazon, there, you know, there you go. And what we've seen over and over again is that it's really hard to predict what, you know, people are going to want. It's the old Steve Jobs quote about, you know, the invention of the iPhone. They didn't, you know you want it until you have it. So I think if anyone would have sat here a year ago and said, probably the biggest hit show series in television or series, again, the use of the word television these days is a little confusing. And the one that would sweep a lot of the award shows is going to be this Korean series called Squid Games. Like, no one's going to predict that. And yet that's the nature, you know, of the entertainment business. I think companies that are the most successful, and Netflix probably came the closest to this, is trying to use the best of both worlds. Like, Hollywood will have a tendency, and people work in Hollywood will have a tendency, especially creative executives, producers, will try to uphold this notion of, I have like magic fairy dust in my fingertips and I can predict what's going to be a hit and spot the next great talent. And tech business will lead a little bit more with this idea of, I can predict what's going to be a hit based on mining this data, structuring this data, looking at the analytics. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, you know, to be fair.
So I'm curious, from your perspective, like, how does Rooster Teeth, like, what is Rooster Teeth's business model and how do you see that fitting into like the larger Warners these days?
I can't really speak to Warner Brothers. I mean, we create value for our parent company largely through helping to promote and market some of what they do, as long as it's really organic to what our audience likes, which is a lot of cases is some of the bigger franchise series that are on HBO Max or movies. Like, we're doing something to help promote Black Adam. We have a big podcasting business. We did a podcast called Podly, which was the official companion podcast to Peacemaker. We did a companion podcast for the Nevers. But it all comes out of, we make a lot of daily content and we distribute it on our desktop, our apps, mobile, living room, and we distribute it across our social platforms from TikTok and Twitter and Instagram to YouTube and Facebook, and aggregate community where our most engaged fandom on both our website and chat on social platforms, as well as Discord. And the content that generally people come back to around daily content is a little bit more gaming lifestyle, not e-gaming or tournament gaming, but just sort of shits and giggles around games, comedy loosely, some animation. We do a big anime series called Ruby. And so we create intellectual property too. We sell as a third party. We have some series in development at the Warner Brothers networks. We've done some merchandising collabs. We have an e-commerce business. But I think the new management team, which is the Discovery management team, is trying to get their arms around the much bigger business and trying to figure out its organizational structure. And there's a question about, you know, where we'll plug in and whether we will fit, especially in an economic downturn and especially in a period of time where, you know, the large corporations and all businesses, especially with the advertising marketplace being soft right now, are under pressure. So it's a long way of saying we're not the highest priority to figure out. We continue to work with different parts of the company. We have a big convention here. There's, you know, we cross promote certain things, But we're largely content creator. We specialize in social media entertainment to drive traffic in certain places. But whether or not we're long-term the right fit for the company remains to be determined.
So drilling down a little more in terms of what you do, right? So what does a week look like for you? How much is creative? How much is business? How does this all...
Unfortunately, my week is much more heavily weighted towards business than creative. It's probably the most amount of time I've spent on business, strategic, long-term planning, as well as day-to-day operations. Running a business today, and especially over the last 3 years, has been really challenging with COVID, with a lot of the social justice issues that arose in the wake of not only George Floyd's murder and Me Too, but have been a long time coming in terms of personal identity issues and representation, things of that matter, and generational, you know, differences conforming to workplace that's much more millennial mindset related. And, you know, we're a company that was making essentially daily video on demand, high turn content and got locked down and home for 18 months. You know, so we had to shift to live streaming business. We had to really adjust our business models all the time of trying to bring the company into when the company got bought in 2014, and the company that bought it, which was an AT&T joint venture, tried to take this fan service, which was largely a patronage model, and try to turn it into an SVOD. And what the company figured out is it was really good at making premium content. It didn't have a distribution platform that could scale to the size to support the economies required to have its own subscription model. So it sort of blew up, and we've been trying to just get it sized appropriately and live within our means. And that's hard. So I've been spending a lot of time just going through all these transitions, strategic transitions, operational transitions, cultural transitions, workplace transitions. And the creative, I feel like I'm the furthest I've ever been in my career from innately understanding the creative. And there's enough people who understand it in the company that my job's to try to give them some perspective and context and certainly help them out when it comes to trying to sell things as a studio or producer to third parties. But I don't, outside of helping to identify talent and guide them to how to think about stuff, I don't wade into, I trust that they know how to create creative that works.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious, I'm going to kind of pivot to your perspectives on opportunities for students and the state of the industry. Having lived in Austin now and been in LA, where do you see a lot of students are trying to figure out where they should move, where should they should live, what they should do? Do you have perspective on like where what opportunities are available? Should they go out to LA?
You know, I think you've never had more flexibility than you do right now. Part of that is the ability to work remotely or in a hybrid nature. Going, my son who graduated 2 years ago, he's a writer. He works in sports media, doing docs, podcasts, as well as writing. He does some work for Texas Monthly, but he largely works for a sports media entertainment company. He's been able to live here, but he goes out and he works a week every 6 weeks in LA. So I think in this market, there's a lot of desire to have good employees, and you have a little bit more leverage in terms of how you want to work, especially with hybrid. LA and Hollywood are still very hybrid compared to a lot of the rest of the world. I'm not sure that is ever going back. It was always a business where you're mostly in your car, you know, going from breakfast to lunch to drinks to dinner, because it is about networking. I think what you miss to some degree in that is that networking is very personality based and forming relationships with people and being around people. If you're in production, obviously you need to be on the set, unless you're in the writer's room or in post. So I would say Austin's underlying infrastructure from a production standpoint is really solid and strong. The rise of reality television is less geographically dependent on work than scripted is, which is scripted is still largely LA, New York, or some regional international hubs that are emerging. Reality companies are scattered everywhere. There's some strong reality producers here in town. And in the area, and certainly with Magnolia up the street, Discovery owned, that opens up opportunities. With tech starting to become a bigger and bigger owner or player in the content business, and a lot of tech companies being here, while the creative piece is not here, it certainly gives some of those companies comfort that, oh, you're going to work in the Austin office. Roku's obviously been comfortable with that here. And then you got Facebook and Google and Amazon and all that. So I think there's the opportunity to stay here, but I think it's still more production oriented than it's going to be more of executive type positions. But depending on what you're doing, marketing, things that are more support services than the creative executive positions, I think have more flexibility. And if you become a successful producer, I think you can come back here. You know, you start to see some producers, you know, move here, especially below the line, you know, line producers and directors who will travel to go on set wherever they shoot.
It's helpful. In relation to jobs, what do you look for when hiring people, or what makes a good intern stand out?
I've been involved in this college since I've graduated. I really like trying to provide opportunities for students coming from the University of Texas, because I think we're an industry that's still largely dominated by funnels that are coastal, coming from the Northeast and Southern California, and primarily private schools. So the idea that people from public schools who come more from the center of the country, who have different world views and experiences, I think that's good for society, for there to be a diversity of storytelling. So I'm a homer for UT, not just because I graduated, but because I think it really does contribute. And what I've found and what I'm proud of is that I think University of Texas interns and graduates, specifically from Moody, and to some degree McCombs and College of Fine Arts, have a perspective that is pretty broad because of classes like this and learning theory and criticism and industry studies in addition to just production. Because most people, I think, know how to shoot and edit and cut. What they don't really know is industry history. They don't really know sort of how storytelling visually has evolved. And so the ability to articulate that and have a point of view when asked is really important. And I think UT students are really good at that. And they also have a tendency to look for where things are needed to get done and don't wait around to say, what do you want me to do? What do you need me to do? What boxes do you want me to check? It still is about initiative and seeing where things need to get done and basically saying, hey, I see that could be used to get organized. I could help over here. It's creating jobs for yourself, not waiting to be told what to do. And that doesn't mean entitlement, and that doesn't mean, stepping over boundaries, but it does just mean showing initiative, and also being willing to do whatever is needed and not saying, well, that's not my job. That's not my job description. The business is so fluid, and there's also, I think, no such thing as a bad opportunity. Unlike potentially some other careers, you may not get the internship you want or the first job you want. But if you wind up in publicity, let's say, and you don't want to be a publicist, that's still valuable, because you're going to have to work with a publicist as a producer or a creative executive. And being able to say, I know I spent some time, I know what you do, that has value. There's no linear right track. There's no right ladder. And so you know, gaining that network and learning all those different experiences of value. And if you embrace them positively, you know, and play the long game and earn a good reputation, that really goes far, because this is still a business of personalities. In a creative business, even if you're on more of the business side, you spend a lot of time with people, maybe virtually now, but you want people you feel like I can work with. And so your resume is important, but also your attitude is really, really important too.
Good advice.
And I think, unlike when I started, where, you know, that was an era when the people running things were very sure of the business models because they weren't breaking down and change wasn't happening as fast as it is. And consumers really didn't control the model as much as they do now. You used to be told, like, just go sit in the back and shut up and just pay attention and sort of learn. But now you're going to enter a business where the leadership doesn't have a good endemic feel for what's going on. They really don't understand why, you know, you're watching and engaging so much on TikTok and short form content, and don't really understand the appeal of influencers and personalities. Don't understand a lot about where things are going. Very anxious about it. So you're going to get asked a lot of questions. What are you watching? What are your friends watching? How are they? How do they engage? What are they doing? What are they not doing? And having that point of view to not only say we're doing this, but thread it with what you learn in classes like these and at this school about where we, how we got to this moment in time, thinking about creative in terms of learning what you've learned in these theory and criticism and narrative strategy classes, that's not only going to make your answer sharper, it's going to, they're going to be able to connect with that. Like, wow, you can connect those dots. Okay. Tell me where we're going.
Really good answer and advice. I'm going to end with one final short question, my usual fun question, and then we're going to open it up for Anne's ready with the microphone. She's ready. What are you watching these days?
You know, I go down the rabbit hole with all these social platforms, you know, so I'll get just find myself stuck on TikTok or YouTube shorts for what I think will be 5 minutes. And then I realize like an hour disappeared. I'm pretty fascinated by that all. I still watch a lot of like late night, comedy shows, John Oliver and Bill Maher, as well as Kimmel and Colbert. And I watch a fair amount of news. But as far as shows, like, it's weird. I don't feel, because everyone doesn't talk about shows at the same time, I'm starting to get to that point where I feel like, oh, I'll get around to it, but I really got to make a commitment. You know, I'm watching House of Dragons. Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal. I was watching, I caught up a lot on Yellowstone. Watching this Irish series. I like the ability to watch a lot of international series. It's watching this Bad Sisters series. There's this Indian series. I can't remember. It's about this young guy dating who's got like this alter ego comic book character that is funny because it just sort of swaps. It sort of swaps what was sort of the Jewish neurotic stereotype into the sort of Indian neurotic parents on top of them stereotype a little bit.
It's a good list.
Probably what I'm
good list
into right now.
But thank you so much, Jordan. We covered a lot of territory.
Thank you for listening to Media Industry Conversations. This has been a co-production of the Department of Radio, Television, Film and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries in the Moody College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit rtf.utexas.edu/mic and follow the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries on LinkedIn and Instagram. This series was made possible by the work of Dr. Elisa Perrin and Cindy McCreary with the assistance of Keith Berner, Christina Brunning, Laura Brown, Paxton Haven, and Maggie McGinnis. This program was co-produced and edited by Sophia Abbey and me, Hannah Wold. We hope you join us next time for another Media Industry Conversation.